This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Maryland. Going to therapy, alone or with someone that you care about, can be scary. You're never sure what the therapist will say. Will they blame you? Will they think there's something wrong with you? Social distancing can make that even harder, and yet more necessary than ever. Psychotherapist Esther Perel knows that very well. She recently released a special miniseries of her podcast, Where Should We Begin? The series is for couples under lockdown, and it offers the chance to listen in on a couple's therapy session, like this one, with a couple from New York City who filed for divorce 2 weeks before they were forced to shelter in place.
It would be nice if you could each experience some form of acknowledgement from each other about what you are doing for each other. That would go a long way.
You know, can I just have some appreciation for the fact that I am managing these kids and their schedules and everybody's food and the cooking? Can I just get some acknowledgement? And his answer to me was, every woman's doing this.
I always tell you how much I appreciate what you do. I'm also managing my business. It's very challenging with my whole team, you know, scattered everywhere.
But I'm grateful to you for that.
But I'm not looking for attaboys every 2 seconds.
Esther's podcast inspired us to try something new. So later in the show, we'll meet William and Kate, two 1A listeners who've agreed to talk to Esther live on air about the challenges that they're facing in their relationship. First, though, let's meet Esther Perel. She's a psychotherapist and host of the podcasts Where Should We Begin? And How's Work? She's also the author of the best-selling books The State of Affairs and Mating in Captivity. Hello, Esther. Welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Welcome.
What it must be like for you to write a book called Mating in Captivity, and then we literally are in a voluntary captivity, right? I mean, how have your views changed about your advice in that book according to the pandemic, which has everybody in some form of quarantine?
Yes. This is called Mating in Captivity, the quarantine edition. it actually has manifested, you know, one person for everything. Asking one person to give us what normally an entire village should provide, you know, and not just working from home, but working with home. I mean, basically mingling all our roles, you know, as parents sometimes, as partners, as teachers, as colleagues, as friends, as the children of everything, but while sitting in the same seat, nothing is moving. No transition in time and no transition in space.
I wanted to pick apart a little bit of your thoughts on how the pandemic is affecting people's relationships. And can we start with the effect that the sort of overwhelming stress and anxiety so many people feeling society-wide, globally, we're in a state of stress and anxiety. How does that affect people's relationships?
So in the number, the pandemic basically has created a situation in which we have a massive psychosocial trauma, but it is not an event for which we had a warning, then came the planning, then came the onslaught, and then came the aftermath. We are still in the midst of the pandemic, even we are not in a peak moment. We actually don't know much, so we live with a prolonged sense of uncertainty, with a deep sense of unknown, acute stress around how we should manage risk, with generally inside relationships, differences around how people tolerate risk, differences in terms of how people deal with crisis, differences in how people bring their past experiences of trauma, of pain, of chaos, of dysregulation. And for some, it becomes a tremendous resource in this moment. And for others, it becomes an incapacitating fear.
There are also things that oftentimes counselors will tell couples to talk about before they get married or before they move in together. Talk about the possibility of children, talk about how they keep their house and division of labor. I can't imagine too many counselors said, make sure you talk about whether or what you will do in case of a deadly virus and whether you will have still a maid service coming in or whether you believe in masks. How might those conversations go if there is a difference of opinion on how to react to the virus itself?
The first thing to say is that nobody knows. And when you are polarizing, as if one of you is right and the other person is wrong, you have no idea. basically everybody is dealing with fear, with danger, with unknown, with despair, etc., with not knowing what's going on with your parents or with not being able to see your children. So if you think that your way is the right way, that may feel like that, but there is no fact about that. That's the first thing. So then the next thing is, if people are going to respond differently, which is normal, the first thing as a therapist you do is you normalize this. You say, this is normal that you happen. You've done this in other parts of your life as well, not around the pandemic, but you have different styles of responding to risk, to the unknown, to immediate change, to how you need to adapt, etc. One of you becomes hyper-rational and logical and efficient and goes and accomplishes tasks and makes a long list and tries to preserve as much continuity as possible with what used to be. And the other person says, our whole life is changed right now and nothing holds anymore and we have new rules for everything, for example. Now, I'm giving it to you in its extreme version. But the first thing as a therapist you do is you normalize those differences. The second one is you help people be able to tolerate those differences in their midst rather than turning them into blame and attack. It becomes really like the couple you just played. Are they going to compete over who is doing more, over who is sacrificing more, over who should be getting the acknowledgement and who doesn't even deserve it because it's part of the task? Doesn't matter what, if it's a pandemic or not a pandemic, this couple has had this conversation before.
They have. Since you mentioned blame, let me play you this comment that came into our voicemail inbox from Mel.
Both my husband and I are essential workers and have been working even more than normal during the pandemic. And it's been really challenging to find balance. And I think when there's not balance, it's really easy to find a lot of blame. And so we've been struggling with that.
Why, Esther Perel, why do we often default to blaming the other person when we're upset?
Many, many reasons for blame. But in this instance, one of the things is the feeling of deprivation, the feeling that one's experience is not acknowledged, that you're doing and that you've become a function rather than a person, and that you are feeling unseen. The antidote to blame is the ability to actually appreciate what the other person is doing, and even more so what they're doing is who they are. So, for example, you know, they come and they say, can I make anything for lunch? And you can say, that's very nice that you thought about preparing lunch. But you can also say something that says, that is so thoughtful of you. I really feel that you're very caring. And then you're making a comment about the personality, the character of the other person, rather than just their actions. And that goes a long way. It's actually very easy to turn blame around. But what happens in blame is that each person wants the other person to do it first. And they believe change will happen when the other person changes, rather than if you want to change the other, you start by changing yourself.
I wonder if you could speak to the people who are going through all this alone right now. We heard from a number of listeners who said, gee, I wish I had a partner to complain about at this point.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's like, you know, at this moment, either people are feeling choking because they're 24/7 with the same person, either they are feeling longing because they wish that they had another person. So it's really gone into both directions. People who are alone are not necessarily lonely. And people who are with others are not necessarily not lonely. So we need to make the distinction between being alone and being lonely. There are people who are alone who are surrounded by friends and family and loved ones with whom they stay in contact, neighbors for whom they are doing things, so they are being helpful. And as they are being helpful, they matter. And as they matter, they don't feel lonely. And then there are people who feel intensely isolated, with a sense that they have nobody to reach out to, and they're not even going to work, or they don't even have work anymore. And like, who even cares about them? Who thinks of them? Who carries them inside of them? And that experience has been amplified. Basically, the two extremes are amplified at this moment: too much connection and too much distance.
There are a number of other questions from our listeners, but we are going to continue this conversation. Many of us keep these personal challenges private. That is obviously a very valid, completely respectable choice. But sometimes sharing the challenges we're going through can make us all feel a little less alone and maybe even help us find solutions. So Coming up, a brand new experiment for 1A. A pair of 1A listeners in Tuscaloosa, Alabama will share their challenges with us and get responses from Astaire. I'm Celeste Headlee. You're listening to 1A.
Comedian Nicole Byer doesn't consider herself body positive. She just accepts herself as is.
I hate that there's a name for, like, not hating a part of who you are. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's insane.
Nicole Byer on her new book, Very Fat, Very Brave, and How to Love Yourself. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Celeste Headlee. In her podcast, Where Should We Begin?, psychotherapist and author Astaire Perel allows us to listen in on her couple's therapy sessions. So we decided to try something similar today, and we asked you, our listeners, to volunteer. So William and Kate live together with their newborn son, Hawk, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. They've been together for about 10 years and married for 5. And they told our producer that the difficult circumstances of the pandemic, on top of adjusting to new roles as parents, has created some distance in their relationship. William is still going out to his job. Kate feels nervous about the risk of coronavirus for their 7-month-old. They are currently sleeping in separate rooms so that he doesn't wake the baby with late-night work calls, and they miss the feeling of bondedness as partners outside of caring for their son. So, Astaire, I will let you take it from here, and I will only interrupt when I have to.
No, you're welcome to ask questions as well. It is not a real session.
Right. Go ahead. Astaire, meet William and Kate.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Hi. You're welcome. So, you know, give me a sense, since you described the general situation in terms of being new parents, having had a challenging process to conceive, having the coronavirus arrive right at the beginning of your new life cycle stage. What happened in the immediate yesterday, day before, that we can use at this moment to really help you a little bit?
Oh, Kate, you want to answer?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I feel like kind of what was said, we just feel so physically distant from each other because of how, I guess, vigilant we're being about the COVID coming into our home, because William's still going out to work. And there's so many layers of separation already that adds another drive between us physically. So, you know, when William comes home from work.
Do you have any physical contact, or you completely don't even hold hands?
I mean, at the beginning of our stay in place, it was like I was so obsessive with keeping the house perfectly clean. You know, William would immediately shower when he got home, and mm-hmm. I was nervous about him being around the baby. And so mm-hmm. I kind of assumed this mama bear postpartum mindset where I was like, I've got to protect my family, and I'm sorry, but you can't cook us dinner because what if you breathe on the food? Very obsessive, very irrational. And I couldn't come out of that spiral. And we haven't really figured out how to reconnect after kind of calming down and realizing how to protect our family realistically. You know, he mm-hmm. has to be around the kids. I'm going to, like, give him hugs and kiss him, you know, but that's about it.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You wanted to protect. But in the protection, you also created a bit of a rift between you and your partner and between dad and baby. Would that be accurate? Do I hear that well? Okay. Yeah. And have you been able to own that? Not just I was irrational, but my needs, my fears had a consequence on us and on you, and I own that.
I don't think out loud.
Okay. Would you? This is the perfect moment. Because you know it and you feel it, and that in itself, that mending, that repair work is part of reconnecting.
Yeah, I'm sorry I created a wedge between us physically with trying to protect our family. I did think about it, but I never said it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
It's understandable. It's nice, like Astaire is saying, it's nice to hear it out loud, but you know, I just think we're in a tough situation, you know, so, but vocalizing that just, it feels good.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I hear the little baby too.
Oh yeah, he's here.
Everybody's in the session.
Yeah.
You know, so, and this may happen again, and you may have other moments like that. And what you're saying is not what I'm doing is right. And what you're saying is not what I'm doing is my fault. You're just saying I'm doing certain things. I'm new at this. And this world that I'm suddenly living in is completely new for all of us.
Yeah.
Put it in your own words, William.
Well, it, you know, if I might add, you know, another aspect of this that, you know, we haven't really explored yet, but is just the timing of everything. As it was mentioned earlier, you know, I'm working anywhere between 50 and 70 hours a week. And so I get up really early and I, you know, say goodbye to Kate and Hawk. Then I go to work and I get home right as the, you know, nightly shutdown ritual begins. And so then we fall into our parental roles. And, you know, I mean, because of the coronavirus, Kate doesn't really have any, you know, outside assistance, and she's basically locked down to the house. And so, you know, basically when I get home, we follow into this sequence, and most of that is either allowing her to get, you know, a little bit of space to do something as simple as take a shower, you know, or just normal routine stuff. And so by the time we go through our nightly shutdown ritual with Hawk, you know, she's exhausted, I'm exhausted. And so, you know, trying to sit down and do anything other than just kind of like stare blankly at each other on the couch is, you know, kind of a challenge. And so we're that's another aspect of this where we kind of are having trouble connecting on an emotional level too. I mean, yeah, so that's one thing that we're dealing with, you know.
Tell me something. Do you text during the day?
We do. Most of the time she's sending me pictures of Hawk, which I really appreciate. It brightens my day. So.
But I would like to suggest that you also text during the day sweet nothings to each other that are not about things that need to be done or not about things that are only about Hawk. So that, you know, if you have all the rituals 7 days a week for Hawk and nothing left for the two of you, it will wear out.
Yeah.
It will wear out because what your kid needs is parents who are connected. And so if everything you do is to connect with your kid and you leave yourself out of the equation, it won't be good. Do you hear me, people? Does that resonate with you? I'm just curious.
Yes, it does. That really helps put things in perspective.
That's great.
Do you like to play together?
Yeah, I think so.
Give me one thing. Give me an example of play for both of you. Play, fun, relaxation. And yes, you will be exhausted at the end sometimes, and you will look each other in the eye. And then, but what will energize you is if you actually start this play during the day. And that means you don't do updates. You play with each other. You pay attention to each other. You write personal things to your partner, lover, not to the father of Hawk.
Now, Esther, that's such a good point. You know, we have focused so much on the, you know, Hawk's nightly ritual and just making sure that his schedule is, you know, very on point and ritualistic, but, you know, none of this has really occurred to us to transfer to our own relationship. You know, that we haven't thought to establish you know, something, you know, ritualistic or reoccurring for us, you know. So, you know, and just the other week I bought a card game just to have something for us to reconnect to. And I think because we haven't, you know, established, you know, like a weekly ritual night or something of that sort that we just really haven't even gotten around to it. But I think, you know, making it, you know, sort of like a, I guess, like a holy moment, you know, like once a week would really help us improve. Yeah.
We've got about a minute left here, Esther.
Mm-hmm. No, but you're totally, you got it. You got, once you understand the idea, now it's you know, I don't think you're going to have a hard time coming up with many other games that you can do and many other fun things. It's first and foremost giving yourself the permission. Yeah. But partly because you're also isolated, you're not able to really get input from others. What you've done is normal. And at some point, all the energy goes to the baby, the time, the money, the resources, the attention, the focus, the playfulness, the humor, the sensuality, all goes to the baby. And at a certain moment, you have to bring some of that erotic energy back to the relationship, that energy that is playful, imaginative, curious, alive. You need to even it out slightly. As you bring it back to the relationship with little things you do, I completely understand the constraints of your reality, but small things you do will give it value. And the value says we as a couple matter too. And when the couple is watered, it has more to give to the world, including to Hawk. That's the principle. And without guilt and with a clear understanding that this is for Hawk attending to both of you.
I want to say thank you to William and Kate, One Lay listeners who live in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and their 7-month-old son, Hawk. We will continue speaking with the renowned psychotherapist Esther Perel about the challenging emotional time we are all living through. Thanks so much to William and Kate. I'm Celeste Headlee. You will hear more from Esther Perel in just a moment.
I'm Gregory Warner with NPR's Rough Translation. So there's a holiday in the Netherlands where every year thousands of white folks wear blackface. Some people are trying to end that tradition, but in a very Dutch way.
You talk until you reach consensus.
Can you fight racism in a way that brings the whole country with you? That's on NPR's Rough Translation.
If you feel like the past few months have been extraordinarily tough, not just out in the world, but also inside your own head, you are not alone, believe me. So let's talk about it with therapist Esther Perel. She's reached millions with her podcasts, talks, and books. One listener, Dear Prudence, tweets, "This is amazing. I love this experiment, and I want to see more of it. By coincidence, I'm seeing my therapist today for the first time in 2 years, and Esther Perel's advice is so soothing to hear." Remember, we are not a substitute for one-on-one attention. You can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. They are available 24/7, and you do not need to be actively suicidal in order to reach out. It is for anyone who needs help in a moment of crisis. We have several messages which are about broken trust. Let me start with the first one. This is from Karen. Karen says, "My husband and I separated 2 years ago and the divorce was final last November. However, this February, I retired from my career and at the same time learned my husband had had an affair while we were married. Just as I learned this, we went into lockdown and I've been alone in my home. My problem is being stuck like this. I spend a lot of time obsessing about the lies and the betrayal and have trouble moving ahead psychologically and emotionally. How do I break the cycle?"
Oh, God. I mean, you're very aware. You're aware of what you're doing. And in a way, it's like here he is in lockdown with you. You know, you may not have wanted to be with him, but you're spending more time with him in your head than you wish you did. Give yourself the permission to have times off. Imagine that every day when you wake up, you have to spend a half an hour writing about this, about how you're feeling betrayed, about the distrust, the violation. And you have to write. Half an hour is a long time. I would say do it for 12 minutes. It's, you know, you must, even if you want to think about something else, because then when you're done, you're done. And you are no longer to think about it until the evening. And I say assign specific moments where you have to do it. It is the Pasteur, it is actually the vaccine idea that you have to inject the very thing that you're trying to fight. So instead of trying not to do this obsessing, I'm just saying do it, but do it in a much more ritualized, mandated moment and time and space and way. And then after that, connect with other people. I hope you can go outside now, wherever you are, and at least do social distance walks and ask other people how they are. And when they ask how you are, you say, "I've already spent my time with myself. I'm actually here to be curious about you." And find ways to step outside of yourself as a way also of giving yourself the possibility that there's going to be another future. There will be life after this, and there will be other loves in your life, hopefully, after this. It's what I believe, and it's what I think I managed to demonstrate in many of the Where Should We Begin episodes. You know, it's more like at this moment, this is the last thing I would say this. What I will tell you is this. The fact that you learned one thing and that this is a huge thing does not rewrite your entire marriage. No one event reassigns the full meaning of all the years that you've had together. You may still have had good years and done important things that marriages accomplish. Don't allow that to negate and then to feel my whole life was a fraud. That's the one thing I would want to caution you to.
Now, here are two other, again, messages about betrayal, but these are in which they're still in the relationship. So first, we got an email from Amy who says, my husband and I split up last year as he got increasingly depressed and cheated on me for a month before I put together the pieces. We're back together now and things are better, but I'm not sure how to put myself back together so we can move past this. How do I figure out how to trust him again after so much deceit and brokenness? And then here's another message from Rosemary.
My mate and I are 27 years apart in age. We've been together 10 years. He's younger than I. He had an affair last year that he had hoped would turn into sort of an expanded relationship with the three of us, but did not work out. The situation devolved in a kind of a common story of betrayal and betrayed.
These seem like sort of the same question. How does one learn to trust again?
The first thing is trust for what? Is trust just that you want to make sure that that doesn't happen again? Or is trust that you want to know that you matter to your partner? Or is trust that you want to know that your partner is staying with you because they value the relationship and not just because they want to keep the lifestyle? I think that when people say trust, I always say for what? It's really, it's not, trust is a big word that we have to put a lot of trust in. Then the next thing is, when there is a betrayal, there's a few things that are essential for the healing of the partner who feels deceived. And the first thing is that the person who hurt you has to acknowledge the wrongdoing. They have to be able to show guilt and remorse. If there's no acknowledgement of the pain that was inflicted, it's very, very hard for people to, what you say, move on. The second thing is, after there is the show of remorse and acknowledgement and accountability, for the partner to prove to you, to show you, that they also want this to be rebuilt, that they're ready to engage in the repair work of the relationship. Relationships go through crisis. Relationships often go through betrayals, all kinds of relational betrayals besides cheating. But what you want is to know that you value. A betrayal is not just a loss of power, it's a loss of value. It means that I didn't matter to you, that you went ahead and did this thing that was for you and that was going to be so painful to me and destructive to us. So in order to trust again, I need to know that you care about this and you're going to invest in it and you're going to be vigilant about it, which means that you're going to be the one who brings this up. Instead of me always reminding us that this happened, I want you to ask me, how are you today? Is there anything you need to talk about? Should we check on something? Most of the time when somebody else asks you, do you want to talk about what happened again? Yeah. You say no thanks, because you actually don't need to bring it up again because the other person is thinking about it and you don't do what we call today the emotional labor of this thing. You're the memory that makes sure that we don't forget so that this doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
And the third thing is, the couple has to give itself the permission to have new experiences together so that you do cell replacement. And that becomes new memories for the relationship. So these are three things. They're all in detail in my book, The State of Affairs, and in the podcast, actually. Right. But that's a good start.
I'm Celeste Headlee. You're listening to 1A. One more question from a listener so far. JQ asks this: has Esther talked about how to develop new relationships in quarantine, asking for me? What kind of things do you have to ask as you develop a new relationship?
Yes. I actually have done quite a bit on social about this, because I think it's an incredible time for new relationships, because many of the norms are being changed. You know, you're not going out so soon. You're not meeting the person right away. You get to actually engage your imagination as you're talking online, as you're going on Zoom, as you're doing social distancing. I mean, it really you know, it's very important to understand this. There's a shift that is taking place, but people have loved. People have written love poems in the most dire of circumstances. Nothing has stopped us from wanting to connect and wanting to love and wanting to make love even at a distance. So don't let that derail you. The apps are actually really participating in the social change of this moment. People realize what their priorities are. They realize what really matters to them at this moment. And the conversations are much less trivial in many instances because people instantly are asking, where are you? Who are you taking care of? Oh, you're at your parents' house. Why did you go back? Who is vulnerable there? Are you able to help them? Oh, what's happening with your work? Oh, you lost your job. I did too. I mean, come on, there's a lot of, you know, trivia that is being bypassed because people are actually really wanting to know what's going on in your life in this really treacherous moment. So please go ahead and continue to date, and then slowly you'll meet people. People have had to negotiate safe sex for a long time, and now they're learning to negotiate safe socializing.
In the couple of minutes that we have left, Esther, I wanted to ask you, because we're going through not just a pandemic, but a fraught moment. And there is a couple on my block that have just discovered they have very differing opinions on police brutality and racism.
Yes.
How does one negotiate these differences of opinion that may be political or may be societal or about race?
I mean, listen, we are surprised. You know, all the conversations that take place in our society at this moment about the social determinants of health, race, racism, anti-racist movements, they are entering people's homes directly. You know, when there's racism in a society, there's racism in our families. I mean, the family is the prime vehicle that circulates the beliefs of a society. So it's very interesting. The latest season of Where Should We Begin was all about looking at the inheritance, the legacy of family beliefs on love, as it pertains to gender or homophobia or race. And here's the thing. People realize that, you know, when you have such a different worldview, when you look at law and order or at human rights or at are people fundamentally good or not, or what is the use of proper force or should force even be used or all of these things, and you realize that you actually have never discussed any of these things with your partner because for a long time we have made it based more on feelings than on value. That has been the romantic idealization of modern love. And what's happening in the last few years is that we are coming back to understanding that there are many people you can love and they're not the same people necessarily you can make a life with. And making a life with a person involves a certain kind of coherence of values. And that includes the values about the world we want to live in.
Esther Perel, psychotherapist, the author of the best-selling books The State of Affairs and Mating in Captivity, also the host and executive producer of the podcasts How's Work and Where Should We Begin. The fourth season of Where Should We Begin is available right now. Esther, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Remember, if you need help and you want to talk to someone, you can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. They are available 24/7. They will connect you with local mental health resources, and you don't have to be actively suicidal in order to reach out. They have help for anyone who needs help. This conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend, everyone, and thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.